Shalom, welcome to another episode of Inspiration from Zion. I'm Jonathan Feldstein, and I have the privilege of being your host, coming to you from the Judean Mountains here in Israel. I like to refer to it as the original Bible Belt. Inspiration from Zion is a program of the Genesis 1-2-3 Foundation, whose mission is to build bridges between Jews and Christians with Israel, in ways that are new, unique, and meaningful. I pray that you will find this all of those. Through this program, we're excited to connect you to people and stories in and relating to Israel to give you a window to look through, experiencing aspects of life here that you might not otherwise know about. We want this to be interactive, so feel free to be in touch at inspirationfromzion@gmail.com and send along any questions and any comments about any topic anytime. Or you can reach us at genesis123.co and follow and like Inspiration from Zion on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Stay tuned until the end, as always, we'll be offering you an exciting opportunity, and please feel free to share this with others who will also find it of interest. Today's panel and conversation was conceived, about 2 weeks ago when, it's kind of hard to keep up with the changing pace of life here in Israel within a week, much less the last 24 hours alone. The general topic that we hope to get into today is how we Israelis are doing after nearly 2 years of war. We're having this conversation on Saturday night, the 10th of October, recognizing that in just a couple of days, we're going to mark the horrible morning that we all woke up to the news of the Hamas terror attack, hostage taking and massacre that took place. And there's a lot to talk about, but just in the past week and in the past 24 hours of Shabbat, there's been a lot of news that correctly relates to the past 2 years. We're going to jump into that and talk about it. But I want to start today. Let me introduce the panelists who are here with us. Everyone's a veteran of Inspiration from Zion. First of all, alphabetically, we disperse with titles, but Major Elliot Chodoff is a 35-year military veteran and political and military analyst specializing in the Middle East and the global war on terror. He's a respected speaker, a frequently published commentator in a wide range of major news sites and journals. Rolene Marks is a widely respected international journalist and broadcaster and World WISO Head of Public Diplomacy. Erica Shackney is the editor of the Jerusalem Post magazine and In Jerusalem, covering a wide range of issues and global affairs, as well as human interest stories. She made Aliyah from New York in 2009 after completing her master's at New York University. And Rabbi Moshe Tarragon teaches at Yeshivat Har Etzion and the Stella K. Abraham Beit Midrash for Women, also here in Gush Etzion, where I am. He previously taught Talmud at Columbia University and lectured in Talmud and Bible at Yeshiva University and served as assistant rabbi at the Fifth Avenue Synagogue before making Aliyah. I want to start with you, please, Rabbi Tarragon. I know you have a limited schedule this evening, and I think it's real appropriate beginning at the beginning of a new year and to sort of set the tone for however this conversation, as unscripted as it is, will go, for a kind of spiritual update on how we are. But I'd like to, if you don't mind, is that to the extent you're comfortable, also let us know how your son is. We know he was injured earlier in the year and how that affects how he is and how you and your family are doing.
Well, first of all, welcome to the fellow panelists. I have to apologize. I had other commitments this evening, but I would not say no to Jonathan, and I certainly wouldn't say no to a topic of this magnitude. So I wanted to chime in with my two shekels worth and give some ideas. But unfortunately, I have a very busy evening. Thank you for beginning on that note. Part of the reason I'm busy this evening is because in addition to my son, who was seriously injured in Lebanon, I have seven other fighters in the war, two of them who are fathers of many little grandchildren of mine. So they're all running around the house, hanging from the chandeliers, making my wife and I crazy. So that's part of my responsibilities this evening while my sons-in-law are up north protecting our country. My son was seriously injured in Lebanon. Thank God, we're very grateful for the miracles. He's functioning. He's now in India with about, 10,000 other Israelis to get away from the pressure cooker of Israel. And it's a long process. It's a long process. You're thankful for what you have, and you try to lend support and then share with other people. Just along my block, there's a fallen soldier. Our neighbor is another seriously injured soldier just on my little block in Alon Shvot. But thank you for asking, Jonathan, and thank you for the panelists for your support.
Yeah.
Where do we stand spiritually? It's an interesting question. We all view history as a process, and it's a process that takes place on many different stages. There's the political stage, which is the one you and some of the other panelists are going to be discussing tonight. But we also believe that history is an architect and history has a design. And that trajectory is moral and that trajectory is religious. And we're all working together to bring more moral spirit and religious spirit and the presence of God into this world. And beyond the political and military encounter that broke out on October 7th, there's a war of ideas. And those ideas about culture, morality, spirituality, religion, and something I know another fellow panelist of mine, Erica Shackney, helps me get some of these ideas out through the Jerusalem Post. She's very kind to facilitate that, to enable that. We don't believe, none of us believe that God is angry. None of us believe that God is vengeful. None of us believe that God celebrates when innocent people suffer. And on September 11th and October 7th, there was more than just the Twin Towers in the southern cities of Israel, which fell under attack. It was the image of God in the modern world. God is compassionate. God is merciful. Human beings are virtuous. He created us in his image. And I don't like to use the word hijacked because hijacked, unfortunately, refers to people who are literally hijacked. But the face of God has been hijacked. And if you ask 10 moderns what their image of God and religion is, they'll associate it with death and murder and hatred and violence. And that is a subversion of God's presence in this world. And I believe we feel we're leading that battle to restore the image. And I know a lot of your listeners are Christians and Jews as well. This is a shared legacy. The legacy of God as a compassionate, merciful God who cares about his world. There's an interesting book, and I know I'm moving out of my lane a little bit because I'm a rabbi. I'm not supposed to be a literary historian. Fascinating book written by Bernard Lewis. Bernard Lewis was a Mideastern historian. It was actually written before September 11th, but published in the wake of September 11th. And the name of the book is What Went Wrong? And the question he poses is, how did Islamic culture, which had enjoyed so much supremacy for so many centuries in art and culture and technology and math and military and politics, how did it abdicate its supremacy? How did it lose to the Western world? How did the Western world overtake Islam? And that's the source for such Islamic rage, because they see the Western world as having usurped them and surpassed them. And he makes very cogent points, scientifically, economically, culturally, politically. But as a rabbi, I ask myself that question from a religious standpoint. And we all believe in a God who's kind and merciful and who cares for the welfare of his creatures. And when we see a world that is awry with suffering and limitation and frustration, we feel religiously driven to improve our world. If I'm a doctor, because God wants me to heal people. If I'm a journalist, God wants me to share important ideas. If I'm a social worker, God wants me to bring emotional health and social welfare. So I'm religiously driven to repair a broken world. And Western civilization, fueled by that image of God, a God who cares about his creatures, always sought to improve its condition. How would you feel if you lived in a culture in which God is angry and arbitrary, random, and takes out his anger based on the mood of the day? So there's absolutely no impetus to improve your lot. And I feel that fundamentalist Islam has radicalized this, but I think there's seeds of this in Islam as well, where God doesn't necessarily take a vested interest in the advance of the human condition. So I think that that's one aspect of God's presence that we're battling over. And we're not just battling over the image of God. We're battling over the image of human beings. We all believe we were created in God's image. We have a set of traits and qualities that no other creature or organism in this world possesses. We don't look like God, obviously. We eschew all those notions, but we have traits. We're creative. We share our emotions. We share our ideas. We help. We form communities. And because of that, we respect human beings. Every human being that comes into our space. And we don't just respect them, we also respect their bodies, because the divine image rests not just in our immortal soul, but also in the human form that God crafted very carefully and very delicately and deliberately. And just the scenes of what was done to bodies and defiling of bodies and the burning, God forbid, I don't want to say the terms, because even using those terms create imagery that's hard to unsee. But we all knew what we heard about, we all knew the images we saw. And then you contrast that with the way that my children, our soldiers, risk their lives to recover bodies and to bring bodies back to Israel for a proper burial. This is our legacy, and our legacy is under attack. And this attack and this battle will far outlast Trump's peace plan or Hamas's surrender. There's a battle of ideas has been unleashed. And for the rest of our lives, we have to restore our own moral clarity to the people in our immediate radius to try to communicate. What are the values? These are values we took for granted growing up. Most of us are probably at the age where when we grew up, these values were not under assault, but they are under assault. And then the third pivot, just to be very, very brief, I know I'm overstepping my welcome, but there's a cultural war. It doesn't seem to be religious, but for religious people, we have to repair broken cultures, not just broken religion. And all the classic, absolute, traditional values of faith, family, community, gender, humanity is undergoing an identity crisis. When you want to trace that crisis back to, I'll leave that to the historians. My own feeling is it started in World War I, which was a lobotomy for humanity, and they're still trying to recover identity. And certain events of the 20th century created conditions where Western civilization is turning in on itself, aided by Islamic rage. And that's why you see these unthinkable scenes of, let's say, LGBTQ people standing next to Islamicist terrorists who would kill them if they step foot in Gaza, because they have one common goal. They're united around their goal to tear down Western civilization, tear down everything we built together. And I think the people of the United States are facing that battle in ways that we can't even imagine, because we're a little bit incubated, because we filter and curate the information we see. But you guys are exposed to that torrent of misguided and warped value systems. And it's not incidental this has been dragged into this war, because this is, I think, as history is advancing towards its conclusion, I think it's becoming clear that, you know, there are people who want God and want God's values in this world, and people are trying to drive them out. And the people who are trying to bring back God to this world. I think October 7th was very similar to the Holocaust, but in many ways it was different. One of the differences is that there are people who are standing alongside of us now. And there are people who are standing alongside of us, not just to protect us, but sharing the values that we stand for. 1945, we're very alone in this world. 2025, there are good, kind-hearted people and tough-spirited people like yourselves and the listeners who believe this is a joint battle that we're waging together. So I'll stay for a few more minutes, but I apologize that I have other responsibilities.
No, don't apologize. We had two of our five grandsons with us for Shabbat, and driving you crazy. But thank God for the blessing, and thank God for the opportunity to do that. I'm grateful that you did take the time, because even though we're going to have a very different conversation today, we have to talk about what's happened in the last week and in the last 24 hours specifically. We couldn't have a conversation about the last 2 years without a spiritual component. So thank you for that. And actually, on that note, I want to bring Erica in. I Rabbi Tarek, and we live real close to each other, except for bumping into each other once, where at a time that it wasn't appropriate really to be social, which relates to my article that was in the Jerusalem Post magazine alongside yours this week. I love, I have this ritual every Shabbat of reading the magazine, and I look forward. And Erica, I'm so grateful that you keep platforming him and his thoughts, because it's so cogent week after week. I feel like I'm at least having a one-way conversation with you. So thank you for that, and I encourage people to follow you. Erica, we're going to pivot backward and then come to the present, but you put together a really great magazine this week, and I sometimes will text you when I find that, for me at least, that I'm really motivated and inspired, because it's not just the articles, it's the work that goes behind it, fitting everything in. And on that note, as we're talking about 2 years before, I'm curious what was in your head going into the preparation of this magazine that's marking 2 years since the Hamas attack, and filtering in the things you thought were most important, but surely there were many other things.
I can't really talk about it without talking about the first magazine I did after October 7th, which was literally the next day to start working on it, because October 7th was on a Shabbat, on a Saturday, and then I had to go to work the next day and start putting together a magazine. And I remember that Saturday night talking to my parents and being like, how the heck am I going to put this together? Like, we're all reeling. And then they said, okay, you know what? You'll have help from your colleagues. Just move forward. And we did. So just so many stories come up. So that was just the beginning. Now it's been 2 years. We've covered so many individual stories. We've covered a lot of aspects of, like, people that are captive, that have come home, all the civilians that have really come forward. And you know, all the people that have helped from outside the country also. So after 2 years, though, it's really hard to believe. There's a lot of thoughts. Living here, it almost like creeps up on you, because since October 7th, nothing's really been normal. It's just been strange. I mean, we always have a new normal. So after COVID, we had a new normal. But everyone's very much aware every single day of the toll that it's taking on us and the soldiers that are fighting for us and, you know, the people that are not with us right now. There's so many stories behind the individuals, and I just don't want any of them to get lost. Sometimes people ask me, like, do you ask people to do stories or do the stories come to you? And I felt like for October 7th, the stories came to me.
Wow.
And I was able to get like three stories of individuals that I thought went together well. And so one of them was a story about Asaf Hamami, who was high up in an officer, and he fell on October 7th, and his parents have put together a beautiful foundation for him to spread his message. And then there was someone who survived Nova and is now battling cancer. And then there was someone who had his birthday the night before at a kibbutz in Kfar Aza, literally on October 7th, 6th, 7th. His friends left at 4 a.m. And the person that told me about it, I work with at the Jerusalem Post, actually. She works in administration, and she was at that birthday party in Kfar Aza. It gives you chills to think about. And unfortunately, he passed away. So we're just able to talk about their individual stories and how people are going on and continuing the fight. Like, you know, two out of the three subjects, two of them are no longer with us. And one is, and he's really fighting. So I'm just happy I could tell the individual stories.
Yeah. It was well done. I have my copy here, which you can't see because of the fake background. But anyone who wants a copy, and maybe Erica, I'm sure you have a few floating around, will offer anyone who in the next week or so who says, yes, I'll be glad to send them out. It's really good and really important.
I hope that answered your question. I mean, when I think of October 7th, I have so many things that I could say. It solidified all of our identity as Israelis. I don't think I understood Israel before October 7th fully. I said, oh, that's why my neighbor has been smoking for 15 years and hasn't stopped. I'm like, all this stress involved, but I'm like, the beauty of the Israeli spirit and the continuity. But it truly, as Rabbi Tarrigan said, is a fight against good and evil. And, you know, I know that if I were to tell these stories in places that used to be normal when I lived in America, like college campuses or like workplaces, I'd be chased out or looked down upon as a Zionist. I just can't believe it's a dirty word. So I just feel like proud every week that I put something out that proudly shows our identity. And yeah.
This year, you can join Christian leaders from around the world who are lining up to participate in Root and Branch, the newest hands-on, meaningful, and incredibly tangible way for Christians to make a personal connection to Israel, the Israeli people, and to be a blessing to the people and nation which is still suffering from the trauma of a horrific terrorist attack and war. Root and Branch offers unique comfort and a vision of peace, with tangible material benefits to Israelis who have suffered the trauma of war, specifically in and around the Gaza border area. Root and Branch is a unique agricultural pilgrimage. You will harvest wild olive trees in communities along the Gaza border that were devastated by the October 7, 2023 terrorist attack and massacre. In these communities and elsewhere, we will plant deep and lasting roots among Israelis of all backgrounds, making Root and Branch all the more innovative. Since the war began, more than $50 million in crops have been saved by volunteers. Root and Branch is the first such initiative to harvest olives. Proceeds from the olive oil that's being made will directly benefit these devastated communities, making Root and Branch a critical and significant project to bless Israel economically and spiritually, in multiple ways. Root and Branch is a partnership between the Genesis 123 Foundation and newpersia.org. For information, videos, and media about the experience, dates, pricing, and how you can register, please visit rootandbranchisrael.com.
I thank you for that. I want to, from moving backward, and we're going to come back to that, Erica, and the general themes, if you will, relating to this 2-year, I'm uncomfortable even saying anniversary, milestone. I think that's more appropriate. But we also can't avoid the massive elephant in the room that 5 days ago, our media was blasted with President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu announcing some 20-point plan that was going to bring an end to the war in Gaza and for good and for bad, potentially get rid of Hamas and its influence and get all the hostages back. Just since we turned our phones on again after Shabbat began here a short while ago, there's all kinds of news. Elliot, you and I just started talking about, it was confusing to me reading the reports, and some of them were just a little bit too old, that Hamas did accept, didn't accept, accepted with conditions. Let's just talk about what we understand about that before we then swing to the reality that we're still in this 2-year milestone and how we got here. Elliot, you want to start us off?
Sure. Jonathan, as you well know, I one of the texts, not the most important one, of course, Tanakh is more important, but one of the texts that I always go back to is the Godfather. And toward the end of the book, Michael asks his father, the Godfather, how do you say no to people you love? And I'll add to that, how do you say no to people you don't want to say no to? And his answer is, well, you have to make it sound like yes.
Good.
And I think we're seeing a version of that right now, where Hamas knows that it can't come out and say no. So what it said was, yes, we just don't agree with 20 of the 20 points. And what we're seeing, in effect, and let me sort of take us back, because part of our the background to this is the past 2 years. I want to take us back 20 years. I heard a speaker without mentioning names, because it would be Lashon Hara, as we say, somebody who was one of the instrumental decision makers on October 7th in the military, spoke in our synagogue on Yom Kippur night between Kol Nidre and the evening service about repentance. And again, I don't want to go in commentary of everything he said, but he said something very striking. He said, I learned how you can lose everything in your life and career in a moment. And this is a fallacy. What happened on October 7th was the failure of 15 to 20 years of failed thinking and preparation. And where we are tonight in terms of Trump ordering the IDF to stop, Netanyahu, and I don't think he was surprised by it, I'm sure this is all part of a choreography, but nonetheless, Netanyahu having to do it, whether he likes it or not, is the consequence of our failure to win the war over the past 2 years, which is a consequence of how it started in the first place, going back 15 years plus prior to that. So where we're sitting today is not, in journalism, it's all breaking news. What's happening now? What's going to be tomorrow morning? As a strategist, I say, wait a minute, how do we get here? Mm-hmm. And we got here through a series, and I want to be clear on this. The IDF as a system has fought brilliantly over the past 2 years. This is not a bash the IDF. They're all a bunch of losers. It's rather a lack of political and high-level military strategy that brought us to where we are tonight. Now, Hamas, these guys are, you know, excellent negotiators, understand that they can't say no to Trump. They have their backs to the wall. And here, let's also understand, military operations will not free the hostages in Entebbe-style raids.
Right.
Might get one, might get two. It'll endanger more than it'll save. However, the pressure on Hamas is critical, in part of as part of the coercive diplomacy to get them to come to some sort of an agreement. They don't want to give up the hostages, and they've already said, "Well, yeah, we'll give them all up in 72 hours, but not in 72 hours, and not all of them, and we don't know where they are." And by the way, this is not a surprise. This is stuff that I've been saying now for months. Yes, but it's not realistic. We really, really, really want to, but we're not going to. We're not giving up our weapons. We're not giving up our position in Gaza. We are going to remain in play. Anybody who's familiar, remember Hamas is part of the Muslim Brotherhood. Anybody who's familiar with the history of the Brotherhood in Egypt dating back to the 20s, this is an organization that knows how to...
1920s, 100 years ago.
Right, 1920s. Sorry. You know, at my age, 20s is not now. Right. They know how to dive like a submarine, disappear, pop back up 5, 10, 15 years later. They've got all the time in the world. And this is all classic Brotherhood, classic Hamas.
Yeah.
The question, I think, right now is... And this is the great unknown variable. And from the time Shabbat ended till the time I came on, I've been frantically reading everything I possibly can that's happened over the past 24 hours. I'll distill it down to this. What will be the response? And I'm not criticizing President Trump in any way. I'm not a Trump supporter. I'm not a Trump opponent. Everybody knows the man is erratic. What will his response be when, not if, but when Hamas shows that it's playing games, number one, and two, when it starts launching attacks against Israeli troops in Gaza? Will he, the most recent report that came out, as they said, he's not going to tolerate a delay. They better hurry up and come to some conclusion or else. Look, we've heard Trump's or else, all hell will break loose now many times, right? So I don't know. I'm not saying he will, and I'm not saying he won't. This is the big question mark. When they begin to play the games tomorrow, the next day, the day after, and stretch this out in their attempt to do it for weeks and months at a time, not under any military pressure, does he turn around and say, no, gotcha, I'm letting Israel do what it needs to do? Or does he say, hey, Nobel Prize, Qatar business, we're going to keep rolling this along. They're really, you know, Hamas is really being very cooperative. He made a very interesting statement. I believe Hamas wants peace. I suggest that he read the charter, the Hamas charter. So how much is rhetoric? How much does he believe? How much is Witkoff and Blair and others having an effect? These are unanswerable questions from where we're sitting, and we're just going to have to watch over the next days and weeks and see what the outcome is.
Thank you. Raline, as Elliot's speaking, first of all, I want your perspective on the last 5 days, by the last 24 hours specifically. But one of the questions in addition to Elliot correctly saying that President Trump has issued very declarative statements, all hell will break loose, they'll have hell to pay. I mean, we're talking about in 10 months since he was inaugurated again, no fewer such comments than once a month about hell breaking loose. And unless I'm not aware of it, the definition of that, I don't think it has. To me, it's coming across as crying wolf. And Elliot, you're right to ask the question, well, what will happen this time? But Raline, you were born in a country that is currently one of the leaders in accusing Israel of genocide and ethnic cleansing and all of the most horrible things that we could be accused of. And I'm wondering, feel free to respond in any way, but what your specific thoughts are, not specifically relating to South Africa, but what about the rest of the world that's also signed on to the Trump plan and say, yeah. But when, and Elliot said correctly, when and not if Hamas violates the terms, will all of those countries say, well, Israel was really sincere this time and Hamas wasn't, and therefore we're pivoting and standing with Israel four square? What do you think?
It's going to be very interesting to see, because as we've seen in the past couple of weeks, a whole tranche of countries recognizing a Palestinian state, and we warned them of this. We warned them against rewarding terrorism, and effectively they have rendered themselves irrelevant. I found it quite amusing over the last, I'd say, 12 or so hours, watching Keir Starmer and Mark Carney falling over themselves to say, we are ready to stand by and give whatever help is needed. But you're not trusted anymore. You're not trusted by Israel. You're not trusted by the United States. You've effectively rendered yourself irrelevant by recognizing a Palestinian state. And unfortunately, in countries like the United Kingdom, with the horrific attack in Manchester on Yom Kippur, I think that was a brutal lesson of what happens when you reward terrorists too soon. But also, I think while it's important to discuss the plan on the table, and I want to be cautiously optimistic, and I want to give President Trump the benefit of the doubt that he's kind of lined up all his cards perfectly. And, you know, the one missing card is Hamas. I wonder if he understands them as intensely as we do, but he's lined it up so perfectly that they have no choice but to accept. But we know that they're not going to. We know that they're going to draw it out as long as possible. So I think this is the most tense chess game that we are currently watching. But it is important to remember that we are 3 days away from the second commemoration of the 7th of October. And with all the talk around what is happening in the last, I'd say, 24 hours or so, I think it's imperative that we don't forget that we are very close to the second. I'm also loath to use the word anniversary, the second commemoration or Yotzat of the most horrific attack against the Jewish people since the Holocaust. It wasn't just an attack that was seismic against us as Israelis in our own home where we're supposed to be safe. It was a seismic event for world Jewry and for the world. I go back to Rabbi Tarragon at the beginning saying that we have to look at it from a spiritual perspective as well. And I think what the 2 years have shown is a lot has been brought up to the light to be disinfected. And what we're seeing at the moment around the world is ugly, and it's exposed. What we have been warning has been bubbling under the surface for so many years, and it's brought it up for disinfecting. And we had a very, very crucial but also very painful period in time. I agree with the rabbi that we are in a massive spiritual battle. Certainly us as a Jewish community, we're seeing that metastasizing of the virus of Jew hatred rear its ugly head again, and wondering who exactly stands with us and who will fight it with us. And maybe I'm rambling on, but while we talk about these important events and what's going to happen, let's not forget what got us to this point, that we still have 48 beloved universes captive. And just to play off what Erica said, as a journalist, it has been the honor of my life these last 2 years, as painful as it has been at times, to be able to to be a first responder of history, because that's what journalists are. We're the first responders of history who record events as they are happening. And then I'm sure Erica will back me up when I say the stories of the people that we are extremely privileged to meet and whose stories we tell imprint on us, on our souls. And as we go through the next critical days, looking to see what's going to happen with our hostages, what's going to happen with this plan, so too is it time to remember that we're not just speaking about over 1,248. We are speaking about individuals, families, stories, and we mustn't lose sight of that fact.
Look, thank you for that. I'll just tell you, with my two grandchildren here, I see my wife is watching and she's nodding her head as I say this, I'm sure. They're experiencing, my little grandchildren, 6 and 4 years old, the two big ones, are experiencing trauma of my son-in-law being in away again. They don't know where he is. They don't know what's going on. They know there's a war. And I think that I'd like to be alive 50 years from now for many reasons, but I think that 50 years from now, they will be carrying the traumas even subliminally of the way our life is. The new, Eric, I think you said something. It's the, I don't remember the language you use, but it's our new norm. It's the reality. It's post, and it's not that we're not going back. I think we're back from post-COVID much more, and the memories of all of that will dissipate much more than this in the minds of anybody, actually. And that's actually where I wanted to take this to ask you, Erica, as a journalist. I want to talk about the specifics. And Rolene, no, you're not rambling, because everyone here who's following, no, it's important. It's important that we have Israeli guests speaking on this panel today, not just American Jews or British Jews or Christians from around the world who love us. But the topic is how we are. And some of that, even after 2 years, is still having trouble getting our arms around it on a whole bunch of levels.
The restoration of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel was an earth-shattering event. For Christians, it was a confirmation that God always keeps his covenantal promises. Today, we are blessed to see God's fingerprints in the modern miracle of the land of Israel playing out in our lives among the people and in the state of Israel. This year, on the occasion of Israel's 75th anniversary, the Genesis 123 Foundation has been privileged to bring together 75 Christian leaders from around the world to lend their unique voices, sharing their personal faith experiences relating to Israel and their in-depth insight into Israel's history and spiritual significance to create an historical, one-of-a-kind, high-end coffee table book, Israel the Miracle. Israel the Miracle's stunning imagery will fill your home with the hope of fulfilled promises and conversations about Israel. It's a perfect gift to anybody for any occasion, and most of all, to yourself. You'll also be a blessing to Israel, knowing that the proceeds will go to bless Israelis of all backgrounds. Be a part of Israel the Miracle and bring the land, the people, and the state of Israel into your heart and into your home. Visit IsraelTheMiracle.com to get your limited edition copy today.
Eric, I want to ask you as a journalist also. There's so much corrosive poison that comes from journalists around the world. And that poison trickles down and it stays in people's conscious. There are people in the world, the same as my little grandchildren, who will believe for the rest of their lives that Israel has committed a genocide, is genocidal, is evil, is the bad actor in this. If you could shake the global media by the shoulders and tell them what do they need to get right? What's the simple message for them and then for everyone watching?
Wow, that's a lot. I think what I say to myself, and I have said to myself since I became a journalist, is that there's a lack of honest journalism these days, of real journalism, and a lack of critical thinking. So the journalism, I think, is largely yellow journalism. I mean, it's a term I grew up learning about from the early 1900s or, you know, like back in the day. But it actually is true. What is opinion and what is news? So I really try to keep that in mind when I'm doing the news, and I don't know, like, who does not have an agenda? That's what I would say when you're looking at a news source. It seems like everyone has an agenda. What do I want to get across to the media? Well, what do they want to hear what we have to say is the question. Do they want to believe us, or do they want to just keep believing, you know, what is convenient to believe and fits into their narrative? I think there's two types of hatred, though. I was thinking about this today. There's the Hamas hatred that's like mother's milk. And then there's what the university campuses are creating. And that's just a lack of, because there's such a lack of values and of something to believe in, this is what's replacing it. So as a journalist, I think it's just you have to go forward and be unafraid. And as Israelis and just as Jews, we have to be proud and unafraid and trying not to focus on the bad things too much. I was thinking about that, like all the people that don't like us, the hell with them. We've seen this all before throughout our long, long history. I mean, I don't care if France declared a state. Okay, make it in Paris, you know, go have a nice state. Like, I just don't understand what anyone is doing. I think there's a lot of good news that we should focus on as we come upon this anniversary too. First of all, we were so worried about this young generation, and they're the TikTok generation, but they have been the most incredible self-sacrificing soldiers, and I just hope that they lead us in the years to come. Wow. I feel very good about what they've done, and it's so life-affirming to see that the young generation, they get it and they don't hesitate. They are in there, they're in the trenches, and they are wonderful, and they're all unified together. I know if you put them in the Knesset, they would start fighting with each other. But in general, they're really unified and they understand. And they're so that's really affirming. And then if you look at what Israel did with Hezbollah, and if you look at Syria today, and you look at the pager event, you know, there's so much that we did and so many miracles that we survived. I mean, considering all the rockets that came through and how many injuries and deaths, I think they're like very few compared to how much there could be. And I think, you know, everyone has a different way they believe, but it's, you know, in terms of spirituality, I just truly believe we're seeing tons of miracles every single day. And I also think that the Israeli people have proven themselves to be incredible. You hear a lot about the fighting, and I think it's just people expressing themselves any way they know how because they want to feel like they have some control over the situation. But ultimately, I've never seen the amount of nonprofits and the way people give of themselves and just the way that they let their children go off to war and just don't sleep for 2 years. So that's the message I want to give to people. And the people of Israel are strong. The people of Israel are happy. If you check the happiness index, we're probably still up there really high because we have the family values. So that's what the media should really be covering. What's going on the ground and who really are the people of Israel? Not what everyone wants to say about us. In order to do that, you have to really want to do the news in a real way. And then in order to be a child these days who understands what's going on, you have to critically think. So you can't just take a TikTok and say, okay, this is true. So that's really what needs to be taught in schools, you know, in the right kind of schools, critical thinking and how to assess. And I know a lot of Americans these days are homeschooling their kids because they don't like the message. So I think that's a big skill to develop in them. Hope that answers your question.
No, there's no right answer. That is the right answer. I like to go through a series of issues. Elliot, you seem like you were on the verge of wanting to say something, so I'm going to let you say it, and then I want to try to focus on different topics.
All right, so I just want to have sort of scattershot response to some of the things that were said. First of all, not only Americans are homeschooling, we're homeschooling here as well for very similar reasons. The stress that we're facing, I think I agree, Erica, Israel is, as a country, we're coming through this amazingly, given it all. I just wanted to point out that there's a lot about being written about PTSD. I don't believe that we've gotten to PTSD yet because we're not post.
Right. and
present.
Yeah, presence, traumatic
trauma, stress disorder. Yeah,
exactly. But what I really wanted to relate to also something Erica said about the different types of anti-Semitism we're seeing. I'm co-authoring a book now on anti-Semitism with a very good friend and colleague from the U.S. And without giving too much away, two or three points I think that relate to what you were saying that I think might be helpful. One is that anti-Semitism is a constant. We're not seeing an increase in anti-Semitism. We're seeing an increase in its manifestation.
Yes.
That's number one. And number two is that it manifests itself in different ways. And here I will throw out a spoiler. We've identified three different categories of its manifestation based on three Jewish holidays, Passover, Purim, and Hanukkah. And what we're seeing primarily today is the Haman type, which is the Nazis, Hamas, the jihadis, and at the same time, the Hellenistic type of Hanukkah, which is what we're seeing in America on the campuses, the woke generation. And I'll give you a hint just quickly, the difference. Haman and his ilk not only admit that they're anti-Semites, they say it proudly. Hamas has no problem saying what we want to do is wipe out the Jews. The Hellenists never said they were anti-Semitic. We don't hate the Jews. We just want to bring them into modernity. And so we're not anti-Semites. We're anti-Zionists. Zionists are bad people. Jews are okay. And if you look at the differences between them, you see that they're all basically coming out of the same roots, but we're seeing different phenomena based on different world outlooks.
Elliot, I'm glad to hear you working on a book, because for years I've wanting to promote a book of yours. So we will look forward to doing that. And that should be your first of a few, if not many.
Thank you.
Okay. This is open, so there's no wrong answers. And I'll do my best to kind of keep it governed. And without even looking at my original notes for this conversation, there were several ideas that we need to discuss. One of them is political. Elliot, you touched upon it a little bit earlier in terms of Netanyahu and that he can't say no, but he also has a coalition here. And I've been surprised in the last week that we haven't seen some much more vicious attacks from within the coalition. But also talks about when there will be an election in 2026. The question is, will it be in the first quarter, second quarter, or third, fourth quarter when it's scheduled for? Erica, maybe start with you, only because I know how much you love the anti-Bibi protests that are in your neighborhood all the time. What's your outlook on the political, where we've come, and what's the where are we looking for in 26?
Well, I think, first of all, it's just impossible to know what's really going on behind the scenes. And Bibi had a huge smile on his face when he was with Trump. So that's a good sign to me. I don't know what they're really planning and what they've really decided, what strategic things they've said. Okay, you say this out loud, and then we're really going to do this, which is like the Qatar apology. I don't like the coalition system. America has many failings, but I think that the two-party system really works and the democracy and checks and balances works. The coalition system is always 1 second away from breaking. So, a lot of threats and a lot. But, it's also, I guess it would have been more vicious. Yeah. Well, that's kind of what maybe people are also waiting to see. And what we're going to see, on one hand, it's going to be like any other election. Everyone's going to be touting themselves. Like, apparently already Naftali Bennett is going on podcasts and talking to the international, audience about how he's very good. His English is great. He's charismatic. He's good for Anglos. And I think he's going to emerge. Lieberman's going to emerge. And people started to really think about them again. And I hope that the soldiers and the reservists form a party. I think Netanyahu, despite everything and his lack of responsibility for October 7th, he like still
taking
has,
responsibility, you mean?
Right, taking responsibility. He doesn't want that post, you know, he'll never say, like, you know, maybe some of the things that I did, you know, had led to it, you know, the buck stops here. That's what people really want to hear. But he could still get reelected in a heartbeat because that's the system. He has people that are ride or die. They're always going to vote BB, and they're a sizable part of this population. I don't think that the average person hates him as much as, like, people would like you to think. I think they just want new blood, and they wish he would groom a successor or just let someone else come in. There's a good reason for term limits, and I think he's a great case for that. I don't hate him either. I think, quite honestly, I think people are so sad that they just can't like him anymore. He's like, he did so many great things for us. Come on, just let us love your legacy again. You know, so, but there's no indication he's dropping out, and his followers think he's going to live forever. So I think he's going to keep going. He'll be reelected, and he'll cobble together some sort of coalition. But I do think people that were in the middle more will vote for people like Bennett and Lieberman, and hopefully they can have, like, a very representative coalition. I liked when Bennett had the government. It didn't stand, but I felt represented for the first time in a really long time as a woman. I just think it's a shame we're going to waste so much money on another election. The money could be used so much better.
Are you suggesting that we coronate BB and just say, ride, go with it?
No, I just wish there was a different way.
Okay.
We're going to see the slogans, you know, I did this, we did that, I'll bring you this. But maybe we'll see some fresh blood. Maybe we'll see. It's really hard to say, though. I don't know.
Sure.
If October 7th taught me anything, it's how little I actually know.
Interesting. The fresh blood is a big game changer. If there's a party of reservists who may be very successful, they'll be like the pensioner party of I don't know how long ago, 20 years-ish. They could really swing votes. Rolene, what are your thoughts on where we are and where we're going to be politically?
Loisha was a prophet. I'll say that one thing is for sure, Israel is never boring. And as a journalist, it's the best place in the world to work because you constantly have stories to cover. You know, let's see how we go. If anything I have learned living here is that Israel is gloriously unpredictable. I do predict a strong showing for Bennett in the next elections. I don't think you can discount Bibi. It's going to be interesting to see what happens with the coalition. They're already threatening that if Hamas is left standing, they're pulling out of the coalition. And let's see how we go from there, you know, as if we haven't had enough to deal with over the last 2 years. But at the moment, for me right now, my headspace is very much in the next 48 or so hours to see what's going to happen with our hostages, what's going to happen with the war, to bring our people home. And also, I think until maybe Wednesday, I think this is a time of reflection. This is a time of remembrance. This is a time to learn the individual stories of the people that we lost and the people who fought so bravely. And I don't think we should lose sight of that. I don't think we should lose sight of what we've been through as a country. I agree with Erica. Our young people, I think, are the best of us. They really are the best generation of Israelis. They have risen to an enormous challenge magnificently. And I think this country is extraordinary. We have a spirit that is unmatched by any other around the world. We have weathered the storm. And we keep weathering the storm, but I do predict that we are in for a tsunami of mental health issues and post-trauma. But I think we'll get each other through it. And that's what is, in my opinion, the best of us.
That's
not the politicians, not the political decisions. It's the interaction. It's the stories of the everyday people that make this country the magnificent country that it is.
Thank you. Okay, that's great. Elliot, of course, I want you to chime in on the politics. But when Rolene just said, talking about you alluded to it also, in the present trauma, she's talking about post-trauma. Eventually, we'll be in a post-trauma position and we will be dealing with all of these things. My contention is it will just become part of us, like in the Yom Kippur War generation, and that's how people will exist. But I think it's impacting us for a lot wider. But I want your comments on that. But staying on topic, if you'd like, also any political observations.
Okay, let me start with the first one. We are largely in denial still. I went for a doctor's appointment a couple of months ago. New doctor, story, but regular checkup. She checked my blood pressure, and the first thing she looked up and said, "Are you under stress?"
Oh.
And I nearly fell off the chair. I'm going to be 70 at my next birthday, and I still do reserve duty. I was in Gaza after October 7th. Stress? Me? What? But
goodness.
And here we are.
Yes.
It is funny, but the fact that we can laugh about it is part of where we are.
Correct.
Okay. So I told her my concept on PTSD, and she thought that was very amusing. And I said, and you think you're not under stress? Did you hear the sirens, like, a few months ago?
Yeah.
Okay. Politics. Wow. So here, Eric, I'm with you. I think that the anti-BB movement is more noise than sort of serious political. It's there. I think that it's much more a question that he's passed his shelf life than anything else, although the issue of responsibility, taking responsibility, here I'll go back 25 plus years to something that I said back then, and that is that the Labor Party, which is now pretty much defunct, is never going to recover until it takes responsibility for Oslo. It doesn't have to, you know, say it was a bad decision, but it was us. And in retrospect, it didn't work. And I think that until Netanyahu confronts that directly, he's going to continue to slide up to a point. But yes, he has his, you know, Bibi is king and he's going to live forever, the personality cult and that sort of thing that may give him enough to sort of to stay in there. I do believe that Bennett, Lieberman, a party around Eisenkot, perhaps some Gantz, whatever, will take a certain amount away from the right. We're seeing today with the coalition, I think, the beginning of a transition period. Okay, Ben-Gvir and Smotrich are bright enough not to have done what the left and the Arab parties did to the Bennett government. In other words, it's not going to get better than it is today. Bringing down the government doesn't suit them. That was the mistake that was made by the left back then. However, since we're moving inexorably into an election period, and again, whether it's going to be in 5 months, 3 months, 5 months, 6 months, 8 months, we're moving into that. They have more of an interest now in asserting their position, even if it means bringing down the government, because they're already shifting into election mode.
Right.
Okay. And so that's going to
and
make
that's
it
how
a little.
So they reclaim a part of the right wing votes. They have to stand
exactly.
Why they're just BB's puppets.
Precisely. Okay. Which they couldn't do a year ago.
Yeah.
And they can do it now. In other words, the government, as we approach the fixed election date of 2026, the government becomes less and less stable as more and more politicians are now going to be staking out their territory. And of course, the big question is one that you raised, and I'm actually working with a group of them. I don't want to get into politics. I won't mention any names or groups of reservist reserve officers who are trying to make that transition from a movement to a political party. And it's not a simple transition. You know, a movement is something that promotes an ideology. Political parties' purpose is to win elections. And that transition is not an easy and smooth one. And I'm working, as I said, with some of them to try to help make that transition. Time will tell. New parties in Israel are notoriously unpredictable in terms of outcome. Some of them succeed amazingly well, at least for an election or two, and some of them simply fall flat on their faces. So as always, and rolling absolutely, we are the perpetual livers of the Chinese curse. May you live in interesting times.
Indeed.
There's always something going on here. You don't know what it's going to be until you turn on the news, but it's worth watching. And I'll finish by saying, Jonathan, you know, I don't do prophecy, so I'm not going to go any further than that in terms of where it's going to go. But a lot of stuff to watch for now. Just so many variables in play that it's almost impossible to predict. I just, while you were talking, I looked on the news. Bibi made a public statement at 8 o'clock that he's hoping that within a few days we'll have an answer on the hostages and we'll be able to bring them home. Is that politics? Is it a setup? I agree. I think that he and Trump are in lockstep, whether by choice or by diktat. But when he was in Washington, Trump told him exactly what's going to happen. He wasn't surprised by what happened now over Shabbat. The question is, you know, now how does it play out? And I'll come back to where I started from. What does Trump do when Hamas doesn't play the game according to his rules?
On October 7th, 2023, Israel and the Jewish people suffered a massacre and calamity of unprecedented proportion, the largest number of Jews killed in one day since the Holocaust. That this is even something that we even measure is harrowing. Since then, the Jewish people have never felt more alone, in Israel and around the world. It brings us back to when 6 million of us were murdered in the Holocaust, and few rose to protect us. However, those who did, the righteous among the nations, can never be forgotten. They serve as a beacon of light for us today and for future generations. Footsteps was born in the wake of this most recent calamity, to give you the opportunity to walk in the footsteps of the righteous among the nations, the righteous Gentiles. Footsteps is a boutique travel experience with a personal touch. You will experience stories of the righteous among the nations, their descendants, of the Jews they saved, and the generations that came from them. Through this, you'll be inspired to follow in their footsteps, to inspire new generations of righteous among the nations, especially today, when so much of the world is embracing overt anti-Semitism. In a generation where standing up for Israel and the Jewish people is no longer something to be taken for granted, stories of the righteous among the nations call out to us, inspire us, and are models for today and for our next generations. Please join us and get more information at genesis123.co.
Okay, great. And I want to pivot to talk about diplomacy, which is where I took that question that you raised and asked Rolene. Is one of the things that seemed clear in everything that Trump was setting up before his meeting on Monday with Netanyahu, he was meeting with Turkey, the head of Turkey and Pakistan, and the prime minister of Indonesia stood at the UN and talked about Israel's legitimate security needs and even said shalom. Erica, you were mentioning before, and Rolene as well, in terms of all these countries that have recognized Palestine and as a state and that they become irrelevant. But where do you think that this leaves us currently diplomatically around the world? Elliot, let's stick with you.
First of all, we're in the same place we always were diplomatically. Diplomacy is shadow boxing. I think one of the great examples of the diplomacy versus reality was about a month ago when the German government made a statement they were going to embargo arms to Israel, and the German military said, wait a minute, where are we going to get our air defenses from? Blah, blah, blah. But, the Spanish fleet that was protecting the flotilla was armed with Israeli weapons. So,
I know that.
So diplomacy has always been talk. There's a famous story about von Metternich, the great Austrian statesman, being awakened in the middle of the night to be told that the Russian ambassador has dropped dead, and he shook his head and said, I wonder what his motive could have been.
Very good.
So here I'm going to say that, and again, agreeing with things that both Erica and Raleen said, I take everything that's stated in public with a grain of salt. There's a motive behind everything that's said publicly. What's really happening is happening behind the scenes. And here, just to give away a certain scholar philosophy, I'm a realist in international relations. The ultimate arbiter and currency is power, particularly in this neighborhood, but not only.
Okay.
And power versus weakness is really ultimately where it's at. And here, I think, is where our great sin was of October 7th, that we allowed ourselves to get into a position to at least appear weak. And the consequence was the horrific events of October 7th, and that was a true expression of weakness, at least for 24 hours. Not that the country was weak, but it left that crease of weakness, that opening of weakness that was taken advantage of. And that's ultimately the arbiter.
Okay, thank you. Raleen, Erica, where do you think we stand diplomatically, and maybe perhaps specifically of all, there are several Arab and Islamic countries that have specifically signed on board to this plan. Do you think any of them are lining up to open an embassy and establish diplomatic relations with us? Or Erdogan is going to fly here from Turkey and apologize for all of his nasty comments in the last 20 years?
I don't see any apologies forthcoming from Erdogan. But one thing is for sure, the region has changed, the Middle East has changed, and Israel has come out as probably one of the most, if not the most powerful country in this region. And that is the language here that counts. And I don't think any of us can dismiss the massive diplomatic coup of the president of Indonesia, the most populous Muslim country in the world, speaking about our right to security. It's quite fascinating is that we have seen movement, South Yemen as well, who have expressed an interest to join the Abraham Accords. I think it's going to be very interesting. I think that, and I like to end optimistically, I think we'll see the Abraham Accords grow. And I think we'll see the current Western governments, France, the UK, Australia, Canada, even more irrelevant than they already have made themselves. And it's going to be fascinating to see what happens in those countries. And they must remember, governments change. And I think as soon as we have a change in government in the United Kingdom, we'll see a government back on side, and I think that'll be the same for the others. So, yeah, we're in for interesting times. And all I can say is it keeps me in business.
It does indeed. Erica?
I agree with everything Raleen said. I think Europe has proven itself irrelevant. We have a few allies there, but I think they don't understand the Eastern, the Middle Eastern attitude. They still think education is the place, that we can re-educate. And they just don't understand this notion that, like you said, power. I think India is a good ally that we have. I do think that this whole thing has highlighted to us how we need more self-sufficiency in Israel and how we can't be dictated to. We need to develop our own strength from within in terms of, let's say, our weapons, or I don't know how you go about doing that. I'm not an expert. I do think we have proven ourselves to be very powerful. And I think the beeper, the whole beeper incident just was incredible and took back a lot of the respect that we lost. But how do you sustain that? I thought of so many things to say as you were speaking, and I don't think Erdogan is going to come here and apologize. I think maybe Indonesia, maybe we'll have some normalization. I hope so. The Abraham Accords are a massive success. I think the Arab countries are good allies to us, believe it or not, certain Arab countries. I think we're fighting the same enemy. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. They understand it. We all understand it. I think in terms of the Israeli people, just going back a little bit, I think that there's an extreme lack of trust in the government. We've lost all trust. The Knesset, we feel, is almost like the worst people in Israel. And so you can go into the election, but does it really matter? These people care about them. The feeling is they give themselves raises. They care about themselves. So maybe I'm wrong, but it'll be really nice to see some idealism in the Knesset that is not perverted by the politics. Diplomatically, Israel's a nation that dwells alone, and it always will be. Hasbara, you can blame Israel for it if you want, but I think Israel's at a disadvantage because people want to believe the other side, whoever that other side is. I don't think the world cares very much about the Palestinians. I think they care that we are fighting them, because otherwise they would have come out about the Syrian civil war, which has been going on for such a long time. They don't care. So I don't think we have to worry about people condemning us or the UN condemning us, or I think ultimately we just have to go forward in our mission and keep being a strong country and doing, you know, it's easy for me to say, but doing what's right for ourselves, you know, cultivating that relationship with America. It's very important, but Trump is not going to be president forever. So it's hard to know like where America is going to go. We have good allies, and we have the right, we have our, like, the truth on our side, and we have good on our side as opposed to evil. So let the light win over the darkness. We just have to keep going. Yeah. So that's.
No, I like, yeah. I love that. It's optimistic. And I love the variety of this conversation. Everyone following live here and who's will follow it afterward. You're getting a positive pulse here of how we are, albeit as Eliot used his metaphor, with a little bit of stress on top. I want to begin to wrap up. We could go on all night, and it's funny because by tomorrow morning when we wake up, or certainly by this time tomorrow, things will likely have radically changed or changed significantly enough that will cast light on this. I want to pose this question. I want to ask Pastor Dave McGarrah, who's following, if I can promote you to a panelist and have you just close from your perspective, sitting in Iowa with your own great radio program, and to close us in prayer. But I want to, Eliot, Rolene, Erica, maybe we'll start, where do we start? Yeah, in that order, alphabetically. There's so much that we can and ought to be talking about on the second commemoration in a few days. How we are, where we're going. What do you want the world to hear? What have we not spoken about or not spoken about enough?
Here I'm going to echo. I think that with it all, and there's a lot of it all, Israel is in amazingly good shape in terms of all the indicators, but I want to be specific about the human indicators, a unified country that, with all of the noise, and there is noise of the demonstrations, but I think it's more smoke and noise than content. An army that, frankly, and I know this from the inside, was very concerned about what the results would be of this most recent call up for this next wave, and was very pleasantly surprised at the response, because we know very well that the fear was not of a lack of motivation. It was simply a wearing down socially, economically, personally, and people simply rose to the occasion. The depth of capability, will, support, identity in this country is beyond human belief.
Yeah.
And so here I'll also end with a bittersweet optimistic note. Welcome to Jewish history. That's why we're still here.
Excellent.
And why we'll continue to be here.
Very good. Rolene, what else do we need? You said it beautifully earlier, also reminding us why, you know, let's not forget the people who were killed and the soldiers defending us, not just those who have been killed and wounded, but those who are out there, as Elliot just said, who have responded widely, and the hostages who are still there. What else do we need to be focusing on this October 7th?
I think we need to remember that day. We need to remember those who paid the ultimate price for living in the Jewish state. We need to remember those who defended us magnificently, who did not hesitate, who ran into the fray, and who do so 24/7 every single day. We need to remember our wounded. We wish them all refuah shlema. Our fallen, we owe them a debt that we can never, ever repay. And we need to remember that we are the unbroken, magnificent people of the state of Israel, yesterday, today, and forever.
Thank you, Arlene. Erica?
Beautifully stated by both of you. I think we're... Yeah, we do owe an enormous debt, and we owe an enormous debt to their families, and we have to make sure we support them properly. And even if the government, I mean, I hope the government really does support them properly and support all the people that were, you know, had to leave their homes, and that people do get the compensation. Unfortunately, there's a lot of family turmoil, so we have to be there for those people. But I do think Israel is in great shape for everything. I've said a lot of optimistic things. There's a lot of really there's a lot of pain, grief, and sad stories, and we just have to go through the stages of grief. You know, everybody's been hit in a certain way, some worse than others. You just got to count your blessings, really, and be grateful for everything that you have, and think about what you on a personal level can do to make things better, and to remember that you have a home in Israel, because as anti-Semitism continues, unfortunately, and if you want to learn from history, I mean, at least we have a homeland now. We're not, we're not at the mercy of the rest of the world. So please come join us in this great Jewish enterprise. I mean, come with us and, you know, be in the land, and you're welcome anytime. We want you. The land can accommodate everybody. October 7th, I think it's just like a new Yom HaZikaron too, though. We need to know the individual stories. We have to remember, we can never forget that we got too complacent. You know, we kicked the can down the road. We thought our amazing technology, how did they break through the fence like that? I mean, it was like there was nothing there. And then, they used pen and paper or pencil and paper to communicate with each other. I mean, so that's a lot of thoughts. Ultimately, please join us in Israel. Come visit. We're doing really well on Mizrachi.
I love that, Erica. That's a great way to wrap it up. But we're going to have the cherry on top. Pastor Dave McGarrah is a good friend in Iowa. He is the co-host, the preacher of the TV and podcast, radio and podcast program called The Teacher and the Preacher. He's been to Israel many times, knows Israel and the Jewish people very intimately on a personal basis, but also historically. Dave, you just need to unmute, but I would love to give you kind of last observations and ask you if you would close us in prayer, please.
Yeah, it's been just delightful to be able to be a part of listening to this. I think it's insightful and inspiring in so many ways. And I couldn't agree more in terms of Israel rising above all that it's dealing with and living with and still, you know, sending a message to the world that I'm Israel High. I mean, it's just that declaration. And I love that. And I'm reminded of a saying, you know, the harder we hit them, the deeper they go. They're like a spike. The harder they're hit, the deeper they go. And it's just been, in many ways, so inspirational that the watching world has shifted so much from calling for a Palestinian state, now putting that on hold and signing on to this agreement. And as you say, I think the Abraham Accords have been playing a tremendous role, and I believe that that's going to grow. These nations that signed on to supporting this peace, that was miraculous in itself, especially the two strongest Muslim nations. You know, it's pretty powerful. So I think God has incredible things in store, and Israel definitely has a future. So I'm very optimistic. We continue to pray for Israel. We have a growing number of opportunities where we get a chance to educate people. I met with a university student today who was over the top critical of Israel and wanted to meet with me to say, hey, am I wrong? And, you know, he'd been drinking of the water of the universities and colleges, and I had an outstanding visit with him, and he is going to go do his homework and start listening to some different things. But anyway, you guys have just done a great job. Jonathan, thank you for making this kind of a opportunity available to us. And we love Israel, and we love the Jewish people. And you know what? There's millions and millions of people standing with you. And we rejoice. You may not hear it. We rejoice when we hear great things. So anyway, we continue. I'm going to be in Israel in October. I'm going to be in Israel in January. I'm going to be with groups of people. So we are excited about tourism picking back up and movement happening to get the hostages out. And for us here in Idaho, we have two former hostages that are going to be speaking on November the 9th. It's a couple that got married. I don't remember off the top of my head who, what their names are, but we're very excited about having them come and share the story. And their theme is faith and hope found in the Gaza tunnels. Wow. And I think it's going to be very inspirational. So anyway, yeah. Well, listen, it's my privilege to say a prayer for us today.
Please.
Yeah. Oh, God, we are so thankful we have a God like you. There's none like you. And we are so grateful for your hand being upon Israel and the Jewish people. You know better than any of us that the needs are great, but so are the people. And you have been doing great things. We ask that you'll continue to watch over Israel and all of its people. Protect the soldiers who are fighting. Heal up the injured and bring restoration to those families that have gone through significant loss. And as we always pray, may the God of Israel, who never slumbers and never sleeps, may he watch over Israel and all of our Jewish friends. And may that same God bless America. Amen.
Thank you. Thank you so much. My additional prayer is that a year from now, when we have this conversation, we will indeed be in the post trauma and moving in a positive direction. I want to thank all of the panelists, Rabbi Tarragon, who had to cut out but gave us some great inspirational words at the beginning, and everyone who's following as well. Just wrapping up for those who have been following Inspiration from Zion, as we've done almost since the beginning. We just want to encourage people to continue following and offer an incentive to do so. We have a program called From Jonathan's Bookshelf. What that means is every month we give away a free book. One month soon it will be one of Eliot's books. But for right now, we're giving away a free copy of Israel the Miracle, the book that we published just before the war began, 75 essays by Christian leaders from all over the world writing about why Israel is so special. And that's a $75 value. All we ask that you do is like, comment, or share the link to this program. And we pick one person at random every month to pick to receive their copy. We're grateful to our sponsors at the Willer on Greenhouse in Culpeper, Virginia. If you're ever in the area, pop in and thank them for helping make conversations like this possible. And also to the Coyne family for their meaningful sponsorship. Inspiration from Zion and all the Genesis 1-2-3 Foundation programs are made possible by donations. So please consider joining us to help continue the dialogue and build bridges. If you'd like to sponsor a future episode in honor or memory of a loved one or special occasion, please be in touch at inspirationfromzion@gmail.com. We'd always love to hear your comments as part of a dialogue, especially about traditional Judaism for our Ask the Rabbi programs, and invite you to be in touch on that as well. Please share the link to this with others who also find it of interest and continue to join us right here, where we bring you more meaningful conversations about unique topics relating to Israel that you won't hear anywhere else. Wherever you are in the world, I pray that you and your loved ones are all safe and healthy, and I send my blessings from right here in the Judean Mountains. God bless you.